political activists who know how to make a difference, how to get things done. First, we have an activist who has received considerable attention for his efforts to raise public awareness of the UFO-ET issue.
His basic strategy for advancing the disclosure process is to go over the heads of elective officials, and that is over the heads, government employees, and mainstream media directly to the people with citizen-sponsored ballot initiatives and grassroots news reporting. This idea is catching on, and ballot initiatives targeting other U.S. cities are in the planning stages.
During the first 6 weeks in the spring of 2008, he was interviewed by over 60 local, national, and international news media. His 2008 Denver Extraterrestrial Affairs Commission ballot initiative got so much coverage, he wound up on The Late Show with David Letterman, where he was treated very well by an interested host.
Our second speaker this session has been a driving force, along with Mike Bird, behind the development of exopolitics in Canada. He emerged on the scene in 2005 with the promotion of Exopolitics Toronto, a symposium on UFO disclosure and planetary directions held at the University of Toronto's Convocation Hall on September 25, 2005. It was at this event that the Honorable Paul Hellyer came forward with his views regarding the extraterrestrial explanation behind the UFO phenomenon. They've engaged members of the Canadian Parliament and the Canadian political media.
Since then, he has kept pressure on the Canadian government with a number of initiatives and constant press releases. Further, he is building a Canadian website for the Exopolitics World Network and is a regular co-host on the Richard Serrett Show on Glastonbury Radio.
Please welcome Jeff Peckman and Victor Vigiani to X Conference 2009.
Jeff will speak first and be followed immediately by Victor.
Thank you very much, Cheryl and Stephen. It's an especially great honor for me to be here because I'm very new to this whole area of activism. Less than a year ago, I was not involved at all. And yet, here I am today because the topic that I'm going to talk to you about is something that's been very effective in changing public policy through much of our history in this country. I got into this line of work not really because I had anything important to say. I had no flashy videos or interesting stories of abduction or contact or any kind of encounters like that. But I got into this because I saw that other people had very important things to share with the general population, and they were not being given much attention by the media or by the public. And so that's where I just jumped in and thought I could make some difference, help out in some way. Most of my interest has just been in, you know, entertainment, the TV shows and movies about extraterrestrials and Star Trek and that whole thing. In fact, I was living in Washington, D.C. when E.T. the Extraterrestrial came out as a movie. And we went and saw that, and then went and had, afterwards, we just had a little party, had some ice cream sundaes with Reese's Pieces scattered all over, and just really had a good time, and that was about it. Because very early on in life, because of a couple things that happened in my elementary school, I decided that I should solve the world problems in any way that I could and develop my full potential as a human being, whatever that meant. And that was at about age 10 or 12, and I wasn't exactly sure what to do. I just knew that I had to take those directions. And I saw the relationship between the fact that I was not using my full potential. At that time, people were talking about, you know, how you only use 10% of your brain. And actually, a classmate on the playground ran up to a group of us and said, my dad says you're only using 1/10 of your brain. And, you know, at that age, I took that very personally. You know, that was a direct insult. And so, but I took it very hard as well, and I just vowed that I would find ways to develop my full brain. And so, at the same time, One of my friends told me a story about a group of people that would sneak up on very quiet lakes and ponds high up in the mountains when the conditions were perfect, and they would just lean over and place a little seed crystal of ice on top of the water, and then they would just watch as the entire surface of that water would crystallize. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. You know, I'd like to see that. And that was one other impression that was very influential in my life, because I looked for those opportunities where there seemed to be a problem and there also seemed to be a solution. And I would observe that perhaps those conditions were just perfect for placing some little seed crystal of an idea or a solution into the consciousness of the population and then watch that spread. And that seems to have been what happened last spring. Now, about a year ago, actually 2 years ago, was my first introduction to this topic. I was invited to a lecture that was going to be given by contactee Stan Romanek. George Noory mentioned Stan just when he spoke last night. And that was really my first exposure to this whole topic. And I saw a lot of evidence that Stan presented that I thought was just really wonderful, that everybody should know this. Why wouldn't they know this? Why wouldn't they want to know about this? He had all kinds of evidence. A lot of that is going to be presented in his book, which actually comes out next month. It's called Messages, and you can read a little bit more about his case at stanromanek.com. That's R-O-M-A-N-E-K. And he's already had 6,000 copies pre-sold, and it'll be in the stores, bookstores, in a couple of weeks. But I felt very fortunate to have seen that presentation first, because it was very convincing. It wasn't just blurry lights in the sky or anything like that. There was a lot to it. So I thought, well, good, you know, the public should know about this. But nobody was really paying attention. And then about 9 months later, he did a public meeting where he actually invited the media. And I knew some of the media from a previous campaign. And so I invited them myself. And I said, you know, you really ought to come to this, because I don't want you to spread this around a lot, but this guy has a videotape of what looks like an extraterrestrial being popping up outside his living room window. I don't think anybody came from the media, maybe one person. And that person didn't report on it till about 3 months later. So I thought, how could that be? That's just ridiculous. And then about 2 months after that, I heard a talk by John Schussler, I think who was a co-founder of MUFON and former NASA engineer, aerospace engineer, that did a lot of work with NASA. And he had worked on the space shuttles and I think Gemini program. And he gave a long talk. He had a stack of documents, declassified documents, that basically proved that the government knowingly covered up this whole topic of UFOs from outside of Earth and extraterrestrial beings. I thought, well, great, you know, everybody's going to find out about this. The public really needs to know. But at the end of his talk, I was sitting about two rows back in the audience. At the end of his talk, he said, I don't think the government is going to release this information in my lifetime. And at that moment, a light kind of went on inside of me, and I'm thinking, oh, wait a minute here, you know? First of all, let's remember, we are the government. We are the government. We are not the public servants that we elect. We are the government. And so, from that point, going home, I was home within about 20 minutes, and by that time I had already realized, okay, I know how to do this. I know how to get this message to the masses. We can use a ballot initiative, because I'd done this a couple times before. And within 20 minutes, I had the basic concept of this ballot initiative worked out, and I'm going to explain that a little bit later. On April 29th, just about a year ago, I had taken that concept of a ballot initiative, I had refined it, and basically wrote it so that if it was voted into law by the population, by the voters of Denver, it would create an extraterrestrial affairs commission. All right, seemed like a good name. And I really wanted the emphasis to be on the extraterrestrial part and not just, you know, a UFO committee that would be engaged in looking at all of the kinds of, you know, blurry lights and other things like that, but really to dig into the evidence that indicated the presence of extraterrestrial visitors on our planet. So at that time, I had other things going on. I was involved in a design competition for something in Aspen, and I just started a website promoting this thing that called Metatron Technology. I had some brochures out there. I don't really have time to talk about it right now, but these were things that were happening at exactly the same time. And so I didn't want to get involved in a lot of publicity or anything like that, although I knew that the potential was there. So I just wrote up this draft, and one of the first steps to doing a ballot initiative is you have to take this ordinance that you draft and you take it to City Hall and you give a copy to the city attorney for the city council and the city council director of staff. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell the media. I didn't tell most of my friends. Didn't tell my family. And the next day I got a call from a reporter at the Rocky Mountain News, which is now bankrupt, and as of a couple of months ago, it was in Colorado for 150 years and finally went under just 2 months ago. But when I turned that in, it became a public document, and somebody, that was their beat, to find out what's going on at City Hall. So they did an article about it, and I read it, and I thought, oops. So I warned my family, and the next day after that, two local television stations put me on, and then within a week or so, there was about 15 or 20 interviews from that first act of just putting my little seed crystal of an idea into City Hall. About 10 days after I did that, there was a mandatory meeting with these same two people, just an informal meeting to review what the ordinance said. And during that time, the city attorney said, well, so why are you doing this anyway? I mean, let's just get real here. You seem sincere. I said, yeah, I'm sincere. And so why are you doing this? I said, well, I saw some evidence that I thought people should know, and it seemed like the government's not taking any action on this. So I am. And he said, well, what kind of evidence? And I mentioned some of Stan Romanek's evidence, and I mentioned what John Schussler said. And I told him about this video that I had seen of this, looked like an extraterrestrial being rising up, kind of it peeking in the living room window. He said, oh, really? I said, yeah. It was nothing, you know, I didn't make a big deal of it. But there were, because of the first round of global media attention from 10 days before, normally nobody goes to these meetings. It's just the city attorney, the other person, and whoever is proposing this ballot initiative. And so I walked in, and there were six television cameras there. And the one piece of information that really was broadcast around the world as a second wave of media, news attention from the media, was this video. So all of the reporters that started to interview me after that, they'd say, well, you know, we'd get to a point and they'd ask a lot of general questions, and they'd say, so what about this video? What's on that anyway? Could you describe it? And I told them. And these were very well-known local talk show hosts, and the guy that, you know, exposes all the scams in the city, you know, really trusted people. And they had a pretty consistent response. I would say, well, you know, there's this video, and I would describe what happened. And it was the same response every time. They'd say, well, that's interesting. I'd like to see that video. How can I see that video? You got to let me see the video. So I said, okay. And so I said, you know, after a couple, I said, I'll see what I can do. And so I asked Stan Romanek. I'd not known Stan prior to that. We'd only met once before this press conference. But I said, I'll see what I can do. Maybe I can organize a little gathering. So I did, and I informed these different reporters locally about the opportunity to see this video. I said, well, this will just fulfill my promise to you to show you the video. Stan Romanek is willing to show it. So we'll set up a room somewhere. Well, the media itself turned this thing into this big, very big deal. Jeff Beckman has proof of alien invasion and, you know, all these things, you know. Really built it up. And I sent the press release out, and I hadn't sent anything to the press before that. It was just kind of word of mouth and just what they saw in the news. And then we had the press conference was scheduled on a Friday morning, yeah. I sent the thing out on Wednesday, and on Thursday morning at 7 a.m., I had all these voicemails, you know, Moscow TV and CNN and USA Today and all this. And so that started 12 hours of almost nonstop interviews. And then I stopped in the evening, and then all day I was taking calls for more interviews for the next day and calls about just the press conference. About 12 to 1 o'clock in the morning, I was sorting through all these little pieces of paper, you know, little post-its and scraps of paper where I'd written all this information just to figure out who I was supposed to meet with the next day. And I had overbooked myself on different times, and I was just a mess. So I got about 4 hours of sleep that night, started again the next morning at 7 a.m., nonstop interviews right up into the press conference, did the press conference, and there were, you know, outside the building, this was at a college campus, there were all these vans with their extended, you know, satellite dishes going up, and people were showing up and said, oh my God, what was a shooting going on here? What happened? What's the big deal today? And we walked in the room, and of course that's where they all were. And there were at least a dozen cameras there and about 30 or 40 different reporters. We showed the video. We also gave everybody a copy of the two-hour Disclosure Project DVD. And during the presentation, we had a physicist talk about the evidence that he'd been exploring from Stan Romanek. We had Alejandro Rojas talk from MUFON. And I talked. We showed some of the witness testimony. But the end result of that was that the media only focused on the video and the still photo that we allowed them to have. We told them we had to make them turn their cameras away so that they could not film the video because it was under agreement, it couldn't be released. But that was what they focused on. So there was really nothing that came from, you know, they really gave it very superficial treatment, even though there was a huge amount of media, and it got Stan and I on Larry King that evening in an uplink, and then the next week, me going to New York to the David, you know, be on the with David Letterman on stage, and then Geraldo on stage. And then that was over, and I went back and, you know, was mowing the lawn and just doing, life was normal again. And, but that used up about 6 weeks of the petitioning time. Now, what I want to tell you, one thing about Stan Romanek, George Noory brought up this fact that he had failed a lie detector test, which is technically true. But here's what I want to tell you about that. We were very suspicious of that when it got arranged, those of us that knew Stan and were kind of close to his case. And I'll just read this. This was something that was sent in by a college student in Boulder, Colorado. The person that conducted the lie detector test on Stan last September was from Boulder, and this was the person arranged by Coast to Coast. And before I read this, I want to tell you there's no indication whatsoever that Coast to Coast knew anything about what I'm going to tell you in advance. But this person emailed some people that were close to Stan and basically sent us a copy of an email that he sent to Coast to Coast. And it started out, "Dear Mr. Noory," or something like that, and said, "I recently listened to one of your shows where you said that you were going to set up a lie detector test with Stan Romanek." And then he went on to tell this story. He said, "Through a friend, I was able to meet the person involved in administering the actual test to Stan at a coffee shop, met him at a coffee shop. Fascinated, I started asking questions. After an hour or so of talking to this guy, I realized it was a total setup. It was apparent that this guy is a religious fanatic. The more we talked, the more he revealed. Stan never had a chance from the beginning. This guy told me that he would repeat the same question over and over until he found a questionable response to use. He told me that he wouldn't let them film him just in case, and that he had a moral obligation to stop the blasphemer, as he put it, a moral obligation to stop the blasphemer. He then told me it took him 9 tries before he found one he could use against Stan. By the time I was finished talking to this nut, I wanted to hit him. There is no justice in this world. And I don't have time to go into the questions, but I'll give you one example of one question. One of the questions was, do you know if the boo tape was just the one of the alien in the window, if the boo tape has been edited, manipulated, or changed in any manner? Now the thing is, that's not really a yes or no question. Is the question, do you know if it's been manipulated? Or is the question, did you manipulate it? And there were 3 questions like that. And those, I always hated those questions. If that came up, you know, from a friend or something, I said, you know, I'm not going to answer yes or no to that. But you can't do that in a lie detector test. One other thing was that Stan was invited to delay the test so that the pre-test interview could be done properly with more time. But the examiner added that if Stan delayed the test, then people would say he is a liar. And there were actually 3 different... Stan hasn't been in good health because of all the stuff he's gone through. And there are 3 different health disorders that he has, any one of which is actually a basis for being disqualified from taking the test. And yet the examiner dismissed all of that and took the test anyway. So that's all I want to say about Stan. That, I know that George Noory and Tom are trying to follow up. I've also understood that this man that reported this has tried to contact Coast to Coast and they haven't connected, but whatever this is the case, there's something very questionable about that. Now, let me get back to the ballot initiative. So there were 3 waves of media coverage. And then in about August, and we had at that point 6 months to collect the signatures. About August, I realized there were some serious flaws in the way that I wrote the ballot initiative, and or at least things that could be improved greatly in terms of the qualifications of the people that would be on this commission. And this commission was really just meant to be a board that would be part of the Denver government, along with 80 or 90 other commissions and boards. And its primary purpose would be to gather the best available, credible evidence and make that available to the public and to the city government, just so that people could be informed and empowered to make better decisions in their life relative to all this information. So I changed it. That meant starting over. We had to re-begin the signature process. But during that second meeting with the city attorney, he brought up the fact that something I did not know. He said, well, next spring, we do have a scheduled election, and that's when this would target. But he said, nobody's running for office. There are no other ballot initiatives, no bonds. So the possibility exists that your ballot initiative would be the only thing on the ballot, and it would cost the city about $500,000 at least. I said, oh, okay. Well, in that case, isn't it true that the city council can pass this ordinance themselves? He said, well, yes, technically that's true. I said, well, there you go. So I said, I'll give them 30 days. I'll give them the benefit of 30 days to pass it. And of course they didn't. I won't repeat the responses from the city council. They weren't intelligent. You kind of got to wonder who gets them dressed in the morning. I mean, they were bad. A few people responded. So I said, oh, right. I was right in not involving them in the first place. But by that point, Obama was just about ready. It looked like he was going to get elected. And it was known that there were people close to his administration that were very favorable to disclosure, and you know those names already. So I thought, we'll just sit on this for a while. And then after he got elected, like, you know, the next week or so, I said, I told everybody to stop collecting signatures. We're just going to sit on this for a few months and see what happens. So that's what happened. And then in the meantime, I thought, well, okay, well, I got to do something else to keep this going. I discovered, I was just applying for jobs on Craigslist and saw one you could write articles for something called examiner.com. Now, this was something started by Denver billionaire Philip Anschutz, who owns Regal Theaters and a bunch of sports teams. And it was just a new way to bring news to people and get advertising revenue. So people with a passion and have some ability to write are invited. They're trying to get 12,000 people to do this around the country, and I think they already have about 5,000. So I said, they said, well, what would you write about? And I said, oh, you know, government cover-up, UFOs, that sort of stuff. I was just kind of going through the motions. And they called me the very next, I applied on a Saturday night. They called me Monday morning and said, we want to fast-track your application. We want you to be the Denver UFO examiner. I thought, cool. I'll try that. And so I started writing these articles. And interestingly, the very first article I put up on their website, and by the way, these are not just blogs. They get picked up as regular news. And that was very interesting in itself, because then if you go to Google News, news.google.com, and you type in UFO, when I posted my first article, it went right to number one in relevance out of 3,000 articles that were posted that, or, you know, that were listed that day. It wasn't chronological order. And then I did another one. It went right to number one. Did another one. It just kept happening. So I started inviting other people to write these articles. So now there's about a dozen of us. Several people from MUFON, they're UFO examiners. Michael Sulla, Alfred Weber. We're all writing these articles, and they're all just jumping right up to number one in relevance. And in examiner.com, internally, within the category of politics, Michael's and Alfred's columns rank number one out of over 200 politics examiners nationally. And my column ranks number one, and this is for the year so far, from January 1st. My column's ranked number one since then in the category of gadgets and technology. And it's really amazing, because if you look on the first page, if you do UFO search on Google News, on the first page you'll see typically about half of the 10 listed articles are from examiners. Some are from MUFON, some are people within this group, the exopolitics group. And this is our way of kind of overcoming this restriction by the media, because now we are the media. We're right in there. And our articles are ranking higher than their articles on this topic. Now, so that was going on for a while. And one very interesting thing I'll point out is that recently Michael posted the ranking of the top five people in the area of politics. And you can only see the top five out of however many there are. This is a couple weeks ago. Number one was Seattle Exopolitics Examiner. Number two was Honolulu Exopolitics Examiner. Number three, four, and five were all gun rights examiners. So you got to wonder, are we headed towards some kind of intergalactic showdown at high noon? You know, is that what that's about? And I think it's just that UFO exopolitics are just very, very popular topics, because the news has been suppressed for so long. And now people can read unedited, this is very key, our articles do not get edited by the people at examiner.com, even though there are content managers. Now, what happened in February is that, and the reason that I want to emphasize the importance of these ballot initiatives is that President Obama was in Denver, late February, and he signed his first big bill, stimulus package bill. And everybody that talked, that was invited there to talk, made reference to Colorado being such a leader in the renewable energy economy, which is true. But you know why that happened? It wasn't because of anything that the legislature did. It was because about 4 or 5 years ago, there was something called Amendment 37, and that was the very first time that a renewable energy portfolio standard was established by a citizens' ballot initiative instead of going through the state legislature. And it's what kick-started the whole green, you know, renewable energy economy in Denver. And so at that same talk, President Obama was saying things like, you know, we have to, He talked about helping more of our sons and daughters aim higher and reach farther. Now, I think we can assume that he meant higher than Colorado and farther than Hawaii. You know, he does have some vision. And he also invoked the name of President Kennedy, who he said sparked an explosion of innovation when he set America's sights on the moon. So we would be right to assume that he was thinking beyond the moon as well. Now, he has every reason to start disclosing this information. But I have to tell you, this is sort of where I part from many of the people in this movement in terms of disclosure, because I do not believe that Obama, President Obama, or Congress will initiate disclosure. And quite frankly, I don't think that they should. I think the initiation of disclosure should come from our side, because again, we are the government. And the last thing I want to see is for the feds to get involved in this and totally mess it up. So I think in that sense, John Alexander had a very good point, that if we rely on the federal government to do this, we're going to come out with a Condon 2 report, and just, you can imagine, you know, scripted messages, very carefully controlled information being leaked out because they're afraid we're too stupid or too fearful to really grasp the whole thing, the whole concept and all the details. And you know that the federal government does not have all the evidence. In the short time that I've been involved in this, plenty of people have contacted me. They've said, you know, I haven't shared this with anybody before, but you seem to be a person that's honest and sincere and can reach the masses in what you're doing. I said, well, let's hope so. And so they show me photos. They, you know, they want to show me videotapes. They tell their story. And it's amazing stuff that's out there. And even the clean energy technologies, free energy technologies. We're not dependent on what the government knows to bring this out to the people, to take advantage of these, of the benefits of disclosure, of interacting with extraterrestrial beings. It's really more our call than their call. It's something we can do. It's our task. And for us, you know, and I don't want to in any way say anything that is interpreted as diminishing the value of what Stephen Bassett is doing and all the other people that have worked for disclosure, Stephen Greer, everybody involved. Because, you know, you have to have somebody leaning on the door of our elected officials just to keep your presence there. Because when the door opens, you know, we want our people to be the first to fall in. But at times, it just seems like totally relying on that and only relying on that is a little bit like knocking on the door, the servant's door, to our own house and begging for some scraps. And once in a while, maybe we get thrown something. We may like it, we may not like it. But at any time we choose, we can simply walk around to the front door that's always open, because we are that front door. It's our house. And that's what a ballot initiative does. Now, I've got 15 minutes left, so I want to get right into the very important considerations of what's going to happen in Denver. The big question is, and this is not a rhetorical question, so if somebody knows the answer, just yell it out or something. In the whole history of our country, how many elected officials, elected government officials, during their time in office, have had the will, the courage, and the competence to even to advocate for disclosure of the government X-files? Is it none? Is it one? You think one? Did Congressman Schiff in New Mexico, was he? Okay, was that across the board or just for Roswell? Pretty much Roswell. So really, it's been pretty much none. All right? Congressman George Brown? Okay. Okay. So there has been some effort, somebody that we can appreciate. Well, the thing is, acknowledging the existence of extraterrestrial beings is really a very personal matter. Each person is going to have to decide for themselves what they believe. It's not something that can be dictated by any level of government. And it's a message that I believe is best conveyed person to person in the comfort of each person's home, to friends, to family. And what happens in a ballot initiative, and I've done a couple of these before. I did one in Oregon to label genetically engineered foods in 2002. And that was called the Initiative of Interest by the Associated Press for that year. I did one the next year. It was the Safety Through Peace Initiative in Denver. And it was just introducing the concept that you can reduce the collective stress of a community. And when you do those things, you'll see all the negative social trends and tendencies reduced across the board. And some of that first research was done in Washington, D.C. That was the last story that Dan Rather covered on election night of that year. And he ended by saying, "And that's Zen and the art of city politics." I like that. Another local paper called it not only the talk of the town, but the talk of the nation. And that was true. Just about everybody was weighing in. They even sent people, a team of four people to my house in Denver from The Daily Show. And we sat in the park for 3.5 hours, did an interview. So the reason that this happens and really becomes the talk of the town and gets so much attention is because it engages that power, that highest power of government. And that's, I believe, what's been missing. We've been taking this message, trying to ask our servants to do this job. But even at the highest level of public office, they're still servants. They're not the masters of our destiny. We are the masters of our own destiny. And this really becomes a choice that we can make. So a ballot initiative engages that power of the public. And as James Madison said, fourth president, he said, "The people are the only legitimate fountain of power. And it is from them that the constitutional charter under which the several branches of government hold their power is derived." So we are that highest level of power. And to me, it's as if, you know, there's a difference between you want to plug in your television set. You can take that plug and you can put it near the electrical outlet, or you can put it in the electrical outlet. Big difference, small distance, but very big difference in the result. The very, you know, First Amendment, we're going to be in the First Amendment room tomorrow morning at the press conference. And that First Amendment guarantees the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. So we have that power to do this, and that's, I think, why the media pays attention, because very typically it becomes a David and Goliath kind of story. And the media loves those stories. And so what's going to happen in Denver, this is the third time. I rewrote it, then put it on the back burner. Recently I decided, you know, I don't think it's a good idea for the federal government to take the lead in this. I think we need to take the lead in this. So I restarted the ballot initiative. By the time I get back, we'll be ready to start collecting our signatures again, targeting the November 2009 election. We have 6 months to collect signatures, but because of other deadlines to get on that ballot, we have 3 months. So we'll either make it then or it'll get bumped on to next May. But here's what's going to happen. This is very important to know. That during a ballot initiative campaign, especially a very unusual ballot initiative, it not only becomes the talk of the town in the media, but imagine trying to go into a classroom or being a teacher, like Victor is, going into a classroom and saying, you know, let's talk about UFOs today and extraterrestrial beings. How far are you going to get with that? Nobody even dares to do that, all right? But this topic is not about, in a ballot initiative, it's not about UFOs and extraterrestrials. It's about an election campaign. It's about an issue campaign on a particular topic. And what happens, and this is not speculative, this happens all the time. Entire classrooms all over the city, the state, the nation will pick a ballot initiative for their social studies class, political science class, biology, physics, especially if it has some relation to those areas, and they'll study it. They'll say, well, this is our project. We're going to hold a mock election. This is what they do. We'll hold a mock election. We'll divide up. Half the class will study, you know, for, and half the class will study against, and we'll hold, you know, debates, and then we'll vote in our class. So that's the way you just kind of slip this topic into the classrooms. And these children, these students, become experts in that field. So when this happens, there's going to be a huge demand for information. And where are these students going to look for the information? Libraries, maybe, but the internet. And what are they going to see on the internet? They're going to see top-ranked articles coming from these examiner writers. They're going to see books and DVDs that are from the people that have been speaking at these conferences, from the researchers. And this is just going to flood the entire population of a major city in a way that's never happened before. And I just have a couple minutes left, so I want to let you know things that you can do. I'm not going to be at my table until after Victor is done speaking, because we don't have a scheduled break in between. But if you would like to see this happen, I also don't have a book to sell, but if you'd like to help write a chapter in the book of this disclosure process, I'd urge you to support this campaign in various ways. Certainly there's money, donations that can be applied towards getting the signatures. And there's also an 8-page citizens briefing document that's being created that will actually have the kind of information that you've never seen in the media. It'll have witness testimony. It'll have stories about the CIA siphoning money out of our economy. It will have the quote about the Central Intelligence Agency that owns anyone of everyone of any significance in the major media. That was made by the former CIA director. So on different levels, it's really going to saturate the population with information they've never heard. Not just providing information, but providing it at a time when they want to know it and feel a need to know it, because they take their vote very seriously. It's like a jury trial. You get these jurors, and they're very smart people, and they evaluate the evidence. This is going into the court of public opinion, and the voters are both the jury and the judge, and they're going to weigh the evidence. And there are not enough men in black to keep this from happening. They're not going to be parading down the street, you know, stealing these from the porches of the people or taking it off the internet. And there's going to be information there. And you can imagine that this just in the playground, in the bars, in the backyard, the barbecues, when people are faced with this kind of vote that they're going to be asked to make, they deliberate in a way so much more thoughtfully than our legislators do. And then all the legislation that most of them never read anyway. They're just told, you know, what's a good way to vote on it. So anyway, I have to wrap this up, but that's really it. The campaign, you can find out more at extracampaign.org. That's where I try to keep up on things. I'll be posting this citizens briefing document there, perhaps through the Examiner articles, where they'll be posted. And you'll be able to see the full text of the ballot initiative. And I think this is going to be a breakthrough and provide a missing ingredient to this whole process of disclosure. Because if it's one thing that politicians get motivated by, it's being ignored. The more you try to pressure them, the more it seems to just embolden their own status and bolster their ego, where they can just select, okay, where am I going to get the best votes, the most votes, by dealing with these different requests. But when you ignore them, then they start reacting, you know. It's like, take it away from them. So you're not really important anymore for this. We'll do it ourselves, because we are the ultimate fountain of power in this country. This is the most important issue. We'll take care of it. You deal with your lobbyists and all these little things you do. We'll take care of the big issues, okay? We created this country. We created the Congress. We created the White House, all the court system. We can certainly create disclosure. Take advantage of the information that's already available, get it out to the masses in a very effective way, and I would ask you to support this, promote it, donate. If you live in Denver, sign the petition. If you live in Colorado, help collect signatures. There's lots of ways to support it, and it has so much leverage that it's not a vast expense. But, you know, we will collect some money, and there's going to be fundraising events and all that just to get this thing done. Once it's on the ballot, it'll completely dwarf the amount of publicity that occurred last spring. So my time is up. I know that. I know you're going to enjoy the next speaker, Victor Vigiani. So thank you very much. It's been said that the world is run by people who show up. So thank you for showing up.
Thanks, Jeff. That was incredible, wasn't it? My goodness. I could listen to him all afternoon and longer. Did you get that? And look at him, too. Well, actually, I should have got a little podium here to set up and so I could be at least as tall as he is. Can you all see me after that? Okay. I know you're used to a break after speeches and presentations, and Jeff's got to do something else. Oh, that's right. Okay, I got to get wired. Okay. Don't look, okay? Robert, help. Okay. After that, I really don't know where to begin. I said last year during the presentation that I gave, because I was the last speaker last year, too, and I'm the last speaker this year also. So it's like the whole world's a tuxedo, and I'm just a brown pair of shoes, you know? But that doesn't bother me too much. I've done that before. But what I'd like to do today is look at a totally Canadian perspective. I know that there's been lots of different kinds of perspectives put forward this afternoon and all weekend, and I've listened to some absolutely brilliant speakers. And in no way do I want to, provide any kind of, reflections on those. What I want to do is allow you to appreciate the fact that there is a country north of the 49th parallel. It is there. And Canadians are not just nice Americans. We are a unique breed of people. And we're very inquisitive about things, and we look at things from a very different perspective. And that's what I'd like to share with you this afternoon. Because myself and my colleague, if we could bring up the first slide, gentlemen, Michael Bird, who is the director of Exopolitics Toronto. Michael, could you just stand up and just... this is Michael, he's the director, and he and I work together in Toronto. And Michael and I have done a lot of great work together. And I want to share that with you this afternoon, but I want to make just four or five just brief points before I sort of launch into the presentation. First of all, I want to make it clear that this presentation is that I'm trying to bridge a gap here, the gap between those of you who are intensely familiar with the issue, and there's lots of you out there that have a really good foundation and background in the issues. And there are also individuals outside that are novices and they really don't have a whole lot of foundational knowledge. So I want to try to bridge that gap. Because one of the things that we do in Toronto and the presentations that I've given in Ontario is I talk to city groups who know nothing about this, Rotary groups, community groups of different kinds. And specifically at the University of Toronto during last year, November and December, we had a lecture series at the University of Toronto, three lecture series. And each of them was attended by over 180 people at the University of Toronto. And basically, by and large, these are faculty members, people with PhDs and so on and so forth, students and so on. And they have absolutely no foundational information about this. And I said at the first presentation that we made history in the first time that exopolitics was ever presented at the University of Toronto. And I presented the information, and they were completely aghast. They had no idea, other than the fact they had heard about this thing called a UFO. But other than that, they had no idea that this was an intensely political type of situation. And so from that point of view, we are trying in Exopolitics Toronto not to speak to the converted, but to speak to people who need to know about this, who know nothing about it or very little about it. And I include the media in that. And you'll see that later on as the presentation goes along. The other point that I want to make is that I guess the next category of learners, I'm speaking to learners now, and there's another category of learners, and I'll make a statement here. Anyone here from the any government covert intelligence agency, if you are here, there will be a session for the learning impaired after in the hallway, and I'll present that to you. So if you are there, I'll meet you out in the hallway. And because I'm a teacher, I know what the learning impaired go through when they get confronted with new information. So I'll be able to explain everything to you out in the hallway later on, if your attention span is that good. Was that a good enough shot or what? The other thing I want to do is indicate that, and Jeff sort of indicated this about the metaphor of a door. And Nick Pope also yesterday talked about this. The door to disclosure is ajar and can be opened, but it just depends on whether or not we want to open the door or kick it in. And as opposed to Jeff's metaphor of going around to the front door, I may be a little bit more aggressive in my attempts to get through the door. And the final things that I want to mention to you before I begin is that we have no more time with this. We don't have any more time to him and ha or otherwise dither about this issue. We no longer have the opportunity of stopping children in Africa, millions of them, who will never ever sniff or taste a glass of clean water. And with the energy sources that will be available after disclosure and all the things that we know that free energy will provide, those children that are there right now, that are suffering as I pick up my styrofoam cup and sip on a glass of water that they will never, ever taste. And that's why I do this. That's one of the reasons why I'm standing here. After being a teacher for 35 years and administration as a principal, I know what children are like, and I know how children suffer. So that's why I'm doing this. So with that context, I want you to understand the following. Is this light up, guys? That's just an introduction. Bit of a bias that I want to introduce you to. Participation in North American democracy is largely based on the belief that citizens should never be released into the world unless they've been properly sedated. And I mean that. It's a condition of our environment. It's a condition of every single thing we do. Read a newspaper, it doesn't really matter what it is. Who you believe in as a god, all of that. And I think that it's the role and the function of North American media, the church, and the government. Keep us sedated. Just keep us disconnected from the truth. And I think it's a very important part of how we're treated on a day-to-day basis. Watch CNN any time of the day. You'll get exactly what the foundation of sedation is. Take a pill. Turn it on channel 33. Take a pill. You'll be sedated. Sounds kind of cruel, does it? But it's the truth. I'm sorry. Okay? One of our missions is we have a three-pronged and very consistent approach to how we try to engage the media, academia, and the government. And Michael and I have made a concerted effort to stay focused on those three things. We contact media, you'll see that in a few minutes. We work with academia, with the University of Toronto, and also we work with government officials, believe it or not. And personally, I've briefed two members of parliament so far. The Canadian journey began in this way, with that man. And I have a statement to make, which was not part of my presentation, but I'm going to say it anyways. It came out in the last debate that Mr. Helyu was no more than a bookmark for several months in Canadian government. I can't quite think who said that, but I think he was sitting in that chair there. In fact, Mr. Helyu was the Minister of Defense, not a bookmark, from April 1963 to September of 1967, and I think if I do quick calculations, that's more than a several months. So I just want to clarify that for the individuals involved. Thank you. Thank you. Needs to be said. Mr. Helyu said UFOs are as real as the airplanes that fly over your head. And so began at the University of Toronto in 2005 an absolutely avalanche of information about who this man was and what he stood for and then Exopolitics Toronto took it from there. And as a matter of fact, Paul is still engaged in the issue. He's still very, very much engaged in it. He's doing his biography. I spoke to him just last week. He's completing things. It's a tough road, but he's still completing it, and he's still very, very much engaged in this whole issue. And he needs to have our support, and I know he has mine, because he's a man of great integrity and immense will. This man is an incredible individual, and I would trust my life to this man. So any question about integrity regarding this individual is totally unfounded. That's all I'll say about that. The other thing we want to do today is look at, it's another departure here, we want to look at the release of the Canadian files, okay? We've heard about the British releasing theirs, the French and the Danish and so on, and great media coverage. It just went viral most of the time. But in 2005, the Canadian government released 9,500 files without any kind of media representation. Totally unheralded. Why? Interesting. I want to get into that. So that's the first thing we're going to look at. We're going to look at four very specific memos that the Canadian government has released. They're very shocking, and we'll get to them in a minute, and I'll show you. And what I want to do is look at the media implications of that. There's the website. That's what it looks like. Library and Archives Canada. That's where all of the files are released. I'm not going to read that to you. But what I'd like to look at is some memos and some procedures. These are just indications of policy that the government has set. But there's hundreds and hundreds of UFO sighting reports. But you will see very soon that there is policy developed as to how to play down UFOs. And this is not something that's terribly relevant in some of the other reports that are given internationally. Sighting reports versus containment strategies. What's happened with these reports is that well over 90% of them are reviewed thus far. Okay, and then I've looked at them, and they're just basic, mundane, as Nick Pope says, and they're very mundane sighting reports. Man walks dog, sees light in the sky, and that's about it. Lots of them, 90% of that. However, several of the files within the Department of National Defense are policy directives by ministry officials attempting to contain the UFO issue. It's very clear. And the other aspect of this, as I mentioned before, there's been absolutely no media attention given to this in Canada. Does anyone here know that the Canadians have released 9,000 files? Isn't that in... Okay, well, Frederick does, of course, because I told you, right, Frederick? But it's just, it's not news, and I wonder why. Is there something going on that we should know about? So with that in mind, I sort of started, and I've reviewed up to about 2,100 files so far, and that's just sort of mind-numbing. Click, 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 ooh! And I came up with four very interesting files that we're going to look at right now. I just want to say that if documented evidence of government complicity were to be closely examined, we all know that disclosure would be an absolute media frenzy. If we could definitely say there is complicity, I think the media would be all over it, I hope. And my question, our position statement in Exopolitics Toronto, as far as Michael and I are concerned, is has the political smoking gun of complicity been found in Canada? So that's another question that I think we want to answer. Yep, what's up? Oh, there you go. Okay. Oh, isn't that nice? I feel better. Anyways, let's go on. What might the evidence look like, okay, if we want to try to look at what government complicity is? And I'm a linguistic. I have a linguistic bent. I studied linguistics in university, and I think language, the process of language, is extremely important. How you use language and what it means is very symbolic. So when you look at language, especially from the government and the media, you have to pay very good attention to every single thing they say. Because the nuances of language, there's a subtext of language. If you just read the word, it means one thing, but there's also a subtext. And if you look at that in linguistics, you get to find out what the writer is really saying. So I keep that in mind all the time. When I read children's work, be it creative writing or whatever it is, you have to look at the words. You can, you know, look at the punctuation, but you also look at the subtext of what the children write. So from that point of view, I look very closely at language. The next slide. These are the documents. And first of all, the first document that looks at this, clearly is evident that they attempt to sanitize the position. They clean things up. They make it look like there's really nothing going on. And the thing is, it's developed by bureaucrats and not necessarily by the elected officials, but is used for the elected official signature. We'll see that in a moment. And language, which is used, as I said a minute ago, is used to sort of show how they will avoid or misrepresent the UFO issue. Government complicity will also talk directly and be attributed to officials trying to play down. And you'll see the language in these memos is very clear. They play down and misrepresent what the UFO issue really is. They will show that there's recommendations by non-elected and intra-departmental officials that might lead elected officials to make public statements or sign pre-composed letters to push out to the public to misrepresent the UFO issue. It's quite clear that's exactly what happens. And also policy and the memoranda shows that ministers of defense publicly discouraged inquiries into the UFO matter. I'll just go by that right now. Oh, I should go back on that one. This is really incredible. There is a memoranda that will show you that might discuss the possibility of a contact event. Now, I don't know. I've looked through some of the British files and some of the French, but I don't know any government official who has written any kind of verbiage that talks about a contact event and what we'll do when it happens. The Defense Research Board in Ottawa, for lack of a better word, it deals with munitions and development of war materials and so on. All of these memos originate from that particular branch. And the first memo is from the Joint Intelligence Committee, and it recommends that Canada actually use the United States Air Force policy that was in place in the 1950s to play down the UFO issue. And it actually uses the word play down.